I next met with Dr. Judith Wolf, who began our conversation by commenting on one of the great controversies in the field, the role of bevacizumab in upfront treatment.
Everyone's kind of trying to now rethink, what do we do with results of GOG-218, which was the bevacizumab trial with maintenance, and the ICON-7 trial, the European trial that was the same kind of thing with slightly different schedule and dose. What do we do with that? And I think in another year or two, when the next set of trials come out, maybe we'll have some more information. The GOG trials, both 252 and 262, which kind of take variations on the theme of adding bevacizumab with bevacizumab maintenance, of using intraperitoneal chemotherapy, substituting carboplatin for cisplatin, and changing Q3-week paclitaxel to weekly paclitaxel, like the DOSE-DENSE trial. I think those will be out in another year or two, and then maybe we'll know what the next step to go is from there. I think although both GOG-218 and ICON-7 were positive trials showing improvement in progression-free survival with bevacizumab as part of frontline therapy with maintenance, although statistically significant, it's a little bit underwhelming on, is that going to really change the way we treat frontline ovarian cancer?
What are some of the trials that are being conducted right now by the GOG and others, including industry, that, you know, have your attention or you're specifically looking to see the results of?
Well, I guess, you know, those two GOG trials, I think, will be important to help us determine maybe where the place of IP chemotherapy is, and is dose-dense paclitaxel a regimen that can be tolerated well enough to have us included as a frontline therapy for ovarian cancer? I think that there's a lot of concern about the neuropathy and anemia and cumulative toxicity with weekly paclitaxel over Q3-week paclitaxel. So I think those two will be important. For me, the IP question is important because I do believe with the three previous intraperitoneal trials, 172 and the SWOG trial from 96 and the other GOG trial, that there is something to be said for intraperitoneal chemotherapy and just trying to find something that's slightly less toxic. The other trials that I'm more interested in seeing, not specific trials, but kind of where things go or where we're going to go with the PARP inhibitors, I think that that's a very exciting area. I think that since BRCA1 and 2 mutations were identified in women with ovarian cancer, we're finding more and more women who have the germline mutations and more of the papillary serous ovarian cancers that have BRCA inactivation. And so I think that those agents probably will have a broader use than just women with germline mutations. And how that's going to fit into frontline therapy, recurrent therapy, and how we treat patients and strategize, I think will be interesting. My hope is that at some point we'll have something like the breast cancer patients have, where there's a little bit of molecular diagnostics done to help us determine at frontline which therapy is best. There's a hint that adding bevacizumab to frontline therapy is probably more important in women with suboptimally debulked ovarian cancer, and there may be a hint that using PARP inhibitors is more important in someone who is papillary serous cancer. And so how we can kind of adjust those to more individualized therapy, I think, might help for the future. Certainly, still the biggest problem we have with an ovarian cancer is finding it early detection. And nothing new really came out this year about that. I think the European trial that's now concluded, and we're waiting for the results, I think 2014 may be the earliest, as to whether long-term screening with CA125 is of any benefit will be helpful, because it's still very frustrating when you see a woman diagnosed with ovarian cancer and it's kind of by accident. They went to the emergency room with abdominal pain and somebody did a CAT scan and there's peritoneal carcinomatosis, and that's still the same story over and over again. And it would be nice for us to be able to find those women earlier and find them when they're stage one or two, when they can all be optimally debulked, when maybe you can push intraperitoneal chemotherapy harder. And if we had some way to strategize which patients needed doublet therapy or triplet therapy or a variation of that, would be very helpful.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about practical decision-making right now, given the tools that we do have. And I think maybe your cases might be a way to sort of begin to get into this. Why don't we begin with your 44-year-old lady?
Yeah, this is a very interesting patient because her mother-in-law had been my patient. Her husband's mother had ovarian cancer, and she was my patient for about 10 years and unfortunately died of her ovarian cancer about 7 or 8 years prior to the diagnosis that this woman had. So this woman went to her gynecologist having some pain or something. The gynecologist felt a mass, did an ultrasound, did a CA-125, suspected she had ovarian cancer, and the husband called me frantically. My mom had cancer, and now my wife has ovarian cancer. So she's a mother of two young boys, you know, very active physically, plays tennis, thin, healthy woman, and came in, also had an abnormal mammogram at the same time, so I had to have a breast biopsy, which fortunately was benign.
Could I just ask, was she involved in the care of her mother-in-law?
Yes. I mean, she was married to her husband, and she, you know, it had been a while since I had seen them, so I don't remember exactly how close she was, but she was definitely there. And the mother-in-law actually went home and was at home getting care with home TPN and then home hospice. And so there was a lot of family involvement at the end of her mother-in-law's life.
Wow.
And so this woman, you know, could predict, she thought she was looking at her future because of what happened to her mother-in-law. So, but she had a stage 3C ovarian cancer, so she had peritoneal spread of her disease, but mostly was omental disease and very little peritoneal carcinomatosis, and so she was reduced to microscopic residual. And this was shortly after GOG-172 had been published, and at the time the GOG was doing some phase 1 studies looking at substituting carboplatin for the cisplatin intraperitoneally. And I thought she was a really good candidate for intraperitoneal chemotherapy because she was otherwise young, healthy, had no neuropathy, no diabetes, nothing that would make her less likely to tolerate a more toxic therapy. And also, it was offering her something new that wasn't available when her mother-in-law was sick. So she was put on the trial, and she received 4 courses of her chemotherapy intraperitoneally. And then she did have significant toxicity with a lot of nausea and vomiting, a lot of neutropenia, and eventually just said, I can't take this anymore, and finished her 6 cycles of chemotherapy with IV paclitaxel and carboplatin. And I just saw her a few months ago for her 5-year disease-free survival. She's been in complete remission for over 5 years. So to me, this is an example of, here's a woman who saw what happened to her mother-in-law, was diagnosed several years later. We had a new option, and at least thus far, her story is different than her mother-in-law's. And that's very encouraging to me, and I'm sure to her, but to me as a physician taking care of these women with ovarian cancer, when on a day-to-day basis, you feel like nothing has changed. It's the same, it's the same, it's the same. But over the years, you can really see that we have come a long way. Then this regimen that she received, the intraperitoneal carboplatin with IV paclitaxel, turned up to be one of the regimens in the GOG-152 study that has just been completed. So we also have the fact that she was on a phase 1 study that, with the dose finding of the combination, was able to be part of a phase 3 trial, which may change the way we care for patients down the road.
Now, that trial that you're talking about, the newer trial, does that include bevacizumab?
Yes. So it's a 3-arm trial, and one of the arms is for women with optimally debulked ovarian cancer, and one of the arms has weekly paclitaxel, the dose dense 80 milligrams per meter squared, like the Japanese GOG trial, with IV carboplatin and bevacizumab plus maintenance. The second arm has IV paclitaxel intraperitoneal carboplatin, like this woman, plus bevacizumab plus maintenance. And the third arm has the GOG-172 intraperitoneal arm, which is IV paclitaxel, IP cisplatin at a slightly lower dose than the 172 trial, plus a week later IP paclitaxel, plus bevacizumab and bevacizumab maintenance.
And I guess I would assume we have at least safety data on combining Bev with intraperitoneal therapy, but we don't know the benefit issues.
Yes. And I think with this trial, the question is adding bevacizumab plus an IP regimen better than an IV regimen plus bevacizumab? And which IP regimen is better and or less toxic?
Now, you mentioned the toxicity that this woman had. How do you usually go about preventing that and managing it?
Well, I think that with intraperitoneal chemotherapy in particular, we expect that they're going to have more nausea, more abdominal pain, more electrolyte abnormalities. So the patients are hydrated more than the patients who just receive IV chemotherapy. And the patients will often get a more aggressive anti-nausea medicine regimen than the IV arms. And then just checking their electrolytes and replacing on a more aggressive basis than with IV chemo. I think with, you know, since the mid-90s when we all started using platinum and paclitaxel IV, it's really a well-tolerated regimen, and we've become more and more lax about not checking for neutropenia, not having to check for electrolyte abnormalities. And so it's a very easy regimen for women to just come in once every 3 weeks. Nothing has to be done in between. Very few of them need neutrophil support. And so you kind of become lax about that. I think with the patients on intraperitoneal chemo, you have to be a lot more on top of it. Now, this is an outpatient regimen that she got. And in the current GOGO trial, that was an outpatient regimen. But for the GOG 172 regimen, which is what I had been using off of trial, it's an inpatient regimen. So the patients really get a lot more hydration during the time of their treatment. And I think that I also, to try to reduce toxicity, also try to strategize who I choose to encourage to have intraperitoneal chemotherapy. If somebody is already having any renal dysfunction, any neuropathy, other issues that might cause the toxicity to be worse, it may not be the best option for them to start intraperitoneal chemo, because I think it's most important that the patients get their treatment in, whether it's intravenous or intraperitoneal.
What's your take on the use of intraperitoneal therapy in community-based practice? Are people using it? Are they using it in the same way that investigators use it?
I think some are using it, probably not that many. I think those that are using it are using some, I don't want to say simplified, but slightly different regimen than the published data that's out there, because the most recent trial, which is now 6 years old, was an inpatient regimen, 24 hours of IV paclitaxel, intraperitoneal cisplatin, 100 milligrams per meter squared, quite toxic. And then, you know, a week later, an outpatient IP paclitaxel dose. I think most people in community who are using it have either substituted carboplatin for cisplatin or lowered the cisplatin dose and shortened the paclitaxel infusion and either dropped or continued the day 8 paclitaxel just to be able to do it in their office. I think that because it's a little bit more intense of a regimen and it requires a lot more attention to the patient than you can do if you're in your office and the patient is in the hospital, it's not used as much because of the toxicity. It's also not used as much, and because it's just a time-intensive thing. And if you don't do it well and help the patients tolerate the therapy, maybe the benefit isn't there. And so I think some people are using it in a outpatient shortened or substituted or lower dose kind of way, which again, maybe GOG 252 will tell us for sure which way that should be. But I think 75 or 80% of people, not just in the community, but I think even in academic settings, aren't using it because it's not just tough for the patient to tolerate. It's tough as the doctor to manage. It's tough as the nursing personnel to manage. It's a lot of time-intensive education for everyone to do it. And I think that the trade-off, people aren't quite sure, is the thing to do. And so if we got a simpler regimen that worked just as well, I think it'll be something that takes on. But probably Dave Albert said this 20 years ago too. And unfortunately, when his trial came out, he used carboplatin and cyclophosphamide, and that was right when paclitaxel came out. And so maybe that would have been a regimen that could have been tolerated, but we had a new drug. And so unfortunately, that seems what has happened in the last 20 years with IP therapy.
So are there any situations right now where you will try to access bevacizumab in a patient like this up front?
I personally don't. My personal experience with bevacizumab in the recurrent setting is that I have found it quite useful as one of the options to use for patients. Because I'm a little underwhelmed with the data from the two published studies, 218 and ICON 7, about the benefit of bevacizumab up front, outside of a trial, I don't try to access it for patients.
You mentioned also the dose-dense approach. Is that something that you currently are using outside a trial setting?
No, again, I haven't used it outside of a trial setting. When it was first presented at ASCO a few years ago from the Japanese, I found it to be a very interesting study because it was kind of coming out at the same time that the first hint of GOG 218 was coming out. And I'm thinking, wow, we have an agent that we already have. We know the safety data. We know the toxicity of it. It's not that expensive compared to new agents. And it seems like it's showing us a similar benefit to something like bevacizumab. But because it was only one trial, one country, outside of that one study, you know, I come from MD Anderson in Houston for 20 years. We're very slow to change. We want good phase 3 randomized data from more than one source. You know, it just didn't feel right to me to switch everyone over. Now, I think we're going to have that data from an American trial repeating the similar thing, both 252, which I mentioned, and then 262, which the dose-dense regimen is part of the arm. Then I think I'll feel more comfortable if there's benefit there, changing to dose-dense paclitaxel. I had a trial a few years ago before these trials were open that was sort of a preliminary look at using dose-dense paclitaxel with carboplatin and bevacizumab in a frontline setting just to make sure that it was safe. It is safe, but it is more toxic than Q3-week carboplatin and paclitaxel. And so without clear evidence that it's better, I don't want to submit my patients to the toxicity.
Let's talk about your 67-year-old lady.
My practice is full of women like this because a lot of my research is in recurrent ovarian cancer. A lot of my advocacy work is in ovarian cancer, being at a place where we have clinical trials and a lot of investigator-initiated clinical trials. A lot of my practice is women who've already failed multiple lines of chemotherapy. And I think for good reason, the GOG focuses on second-line therapy for recurrent patients and third-line therapy with its biologic agents, but there's very few trials for women who failed multiple therapies. And unfortunately, there's a lot of women out there who failed 4, 5, 6 therapies before they come to see someone like me, and there isn't a lot else left out there. If you're practicing in the community, what can you give them? So this was a trial that I did a few years ago looking at using capecitabine for recurrent ovarian cancer. And there had just been some studies coming out a few years before that showing that it had activity in breast cancer. There are some old studies showing that 5-FU, 5-fluorouracil, has activity in recurrent ovarian cancer, although nobody uses it anymore because the schedule isn't very good and it's not that great. But I thought that it might be a reasonable thing to try because it's an oral agent and it's fairly well tolerated. And so this woman had failed, I think, platinum and paclitaxel first line. She'd failed pegylated liposomal doxorubicin. She'd failed gemcitabine and maybe one other trial of paclitaxel, and then was registered for this study with capecitabine and tolerated it quite well. And as a matter of fact, had a partial response and then stable disease and was on trial for over a year. And this study, which has been published, showed about a 17% response rate in women who'd failed multiple lines of chemotherapy prior to going on. And so the importance of, I think, studies like this are just that when you're out there treating patients with recurrent ovarian cancer and you feel like you've run out of options, what else can you do? Well, I think that most people are pretty comfortable if someone has had a long disease-free interval, retreating them with some platinum-based regimen. And now we know that you can give them carboplatin plus paclitaxel, carboplatin plus gemcitabine, carboplatin plus pegylated liposomal doxorubicin, all of which are better than carboplatin alone, or you can give them carboplatin alone, or you can give them paclitaxel alone. But when they're refractory to platinum, you can give them one of those agents as a single agent. But if they failed second line and they failed third line and they failed fourth line and they're still performance status 0 and have disease that's measurable, but it's not really interfering with the quality of their life, what do you do after that? So there's a series of bunch of agents that have been studied in phase 2 trials, capecitabine, navalbine, pemetrexed, all of which have some single agent activity. And this is where I put bevacizumab in that same thing. It has single agent activity. And so where do you put that? And where do you add that into the lines? The other one is topotecan. Because what's commercially available and what's approved and what's NCCN guidelines is easy to get to, but you can actually get most of these other agents approved by insurance if you can show the paper that shows that there's some activity. And a lot of women go through 7, 8, 9 lines of therapy prior to succumbing to their disease. So I think it's just important to have more things available. And I think that the GOG can't and isn't ever going to do phase two studies of agents in fourth and fifth line. But I think it's important that someone still be able to do those kind of trials when a new agent comes out that might have some activity in ovarian cancer, because these women are desperate for something.
You know, capecitabine is a very valuable tool in metastatic breast and also in colorectal cancer. Do you think that most medical oncologists are aware of its activity and utilize it?
I don't think so, not that much. And I think one of the other issues with capecitabine and other oral agents are getting them paid for.
Right.
Because it's a prescription and it's quite expensive. And sometimes it's harder, even if you know that it's an option, it's harder to get it paid for and patients can't approve it. Fortunately, on a trial, you know, you can get the drug for the patients alone. But since the trial's been completed, I've successfully gotten it for patients off trial and off study and, you know, showing the data that it's an option, especially when they failed other options. And it's fairly well tolerated, although I will say that the most common toxicity is hand-foot syndrome or palmar plantar erythrodesia, which a lot of the patients who end up going on capecitabine have already had pegylated liposomal doxorubicin. And if they had PPE with that, it seems like they're more likely to get PPE with capecitabine.
There's been a lot of debate about the dose and schedule of capecitabine in breast and colon cancer. What kind of dose and schedule do you use in ovarian?
Yeah, you know, my general starting dose is 2,000 milligrams per meter squared per day in two divided doses for 14 days of a 21-day cycle. Most patients tolerate that pretty well, and that was actually the dose we used in the phase two study with response rates. I think if you go much lower than that, I would worry that you might not have a response. Unfortunately, if you go up to 2,500 milligrams per meter squared per day, there's more nausea and vomiting. And if you think about ovarian cancer separate from breast cancer, a lot of the disease is intraperitoneal, and by the time someone's on fourth or fifth line chemo, they are more likely to have a little bit of GI dysfunction anyway, and so you want to make sure that you're not adding to that by giving them a chemotherapy that might increase their nausea and vomiting. Also, of course, make sure the patients take it with food. And I think if you're cautious about making sure the patient has good bowel function when they start and moderate the dose and they take it with food, I've had only one patient I can think of off the trial who couldn't tolerate it, and all the patients on the trial tolerated it well.
Interesting. Let's talk about your 57-year-old lady.
This is a lovely lady, single mom. Gosh, it ended up that the woman who became her daughter-in-law worked in my clinic, unbeknownst to me. I'm just a lovely, lovely woman who was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. I did her surgery. She was optimally debulked. She got, I think, IV paclitaxel carboplatin as first-line therapy. Had remission for about a year and a half. Got retreated with platinum-based regimen and then progressed and kind of over time failed a couple of lines of therapy. And this was just shortly after, I think that GOG 218 was open when I started her on bevacizumab for recurrence. And she actually did pretty well on it. She had some stable disease for about 6 or 7 months. And then unfortunately, she developed some renal dysfunction from the bevacizumab and developed edema and her creatinine bumped. And we eventually had to take her off of the therapy. And then nothing else worked. And I think the reason I put her on here as someone to talk about is that one of the other things I sort of worry a little bit about once I start bevacizumab in the recurrent setting is stopping it. So even if I start it as a single agent and the patient slowly progresses, if I add something else in, I usually try to keep the bevacizumab going if they're tolerating it. Because a lot of times it seems like you lose any ground you've gained if you stop it. And I know that there's been some at least talk about that being one of the things that can happen with bevacizumab. And I know that even in the frontline trials, if you look at when the lines cross with survival, it's when the bevacizumab is stopped. And so a lot of times, and I didn't do it in this patient, but a lot of times when I start bevacizumab as treatment for recurrent ovarian cancer, I'll start it with low-dose oral cyclophosphamide. And there was a trial by Augustin Garcia that was one of the first three bevacizumab trials for recurrent ovarian cancer that came out, where he treated patients with just 50 milligrams a day, PO, of cyclophosphamide, along with bevacizumab. He did it 10 milligrams per kilogram every other week and showed it was very well tolerated, and the patients, about, I think, 18% in his trial responded. And so sometimes I'll start out with that, and then if they progress, we'll flip the cyclophosphamide out and switch into topotecan or gemcitabine or something else that the patient may not have had and continue the bevacizumab going without stopping it unless there's a reason for toxicity.
There's been a lot of debate about this issue of continuing Bev on progression. And finally, we saw some randomized data just at ASCO in colorectal cancer, pretty big European study, at least in that disease, showing a benefit of continuing the Bev and keeping the chemo going.
Yeah.
Are there any discussion about looking at those kinds of strategies in ovarian cancers in trials?
Well, you know, not to date. I think the question with ovarian cancer is, where is bevacizumab going to fit, and does it really have a future if it doesn't get FDA labeling for ovarian cancer? And if it does get labeling, is it going to be recurrence or is it going to be frontline setting? And so part of designing the trial is going to be looking not just at the scientific aspect, but the logistical, how are we actually going to be able to use it? But I think certainly in the recurrent setting where it's fairly easy to get bevacizumab paid for and patients are able to get it, that's just some evidence that maybe to continue it on. But to do a trial in recurrent ovarian cancer to try to answer that question, I think it would be very complicated. The number of patients is smaller. It's all muddied by the kind of treatment they've had beforehand and afterwards. I mean, I think even if you take a recurrent trial like the OCEANS trial, which was carboplatin gemcitabine plus or minus bevacizumab, which showed a benefit to bevacizumab and bevacizumab maintenance even in a recurrent setting, to then say, oh, should you just keep the bevacizumab going on indefinitely, even if there's progression, and change the chemo, I think it's a hard trial to do with a small amount of patients. We may have to extrapolate from other sites like colon cancer, where it's a more common disease.
So, you know, seeing patients that other physicians have seen, have you encountered any or many myths or misperceptions or things that people do or don't do that you do differently?
I think the thing that, you know, ovarian cancer in particular for me, because these women live a long time and they go through multiple therapies, I think that what I see that I do differently the most commonly is that people will change therapies too quickly, in my opinion, too quickly. So if somebody starts a new, say they have recurrent ovarian cancer and they failed something and you're going to change to another therapy, instead of giving that therapy a chance to see if it works, they'll change after one or two cycles just because the CA-125 is going up without actually imaging or clinically determining that the cancer has really progressed. And I think that, unfortunately, sometimes some of these agents take three or four cycles till you really know if they're going to respond. And there's actually a study where they looked at pegylated liposomal doxorubicin in particular, but it took up to four cycles before some people had a response. And before that, their CA-125 might still be going up. And so I think that sometimes you can toss a drug away that might at least hold someone stable for a period of 4 to 6 or 8 months too quickly if you don't actually give enough of the drug to know for sure that it's working or not, and not just go on the change of CA-125, but actually want to see progression of the disease by imaging or exam or however you're measuring progression. Because the CA-125 is not specific enough or sensitive enough to say for sure a drug is or isn't working. And so I think that's probably the thing that I see the most commonly. And then sometimes, unfortunately, you'll see someone who's 6 or 8 months into their recurrence, and they've already been through three or four drugs, where you might have been able to push that out to a year and a half or 2 years before you went through all those drugs if you really let them have enough time. And along with that same thing is changing drugs when they're stable disease. So somebody has recurrent ovarian cancer, they're probably not curable. And so in my mind, the goal is to keep them alive as long as possible with the best quality of life. And so if they have no symptoms from their cancer, and you put them on a therapy and their cancer is staying stable, that to me is a win. If they're tolerating the therapy and they have good quality of life and their cancer isn't progressing, then you want to continue on that therapy until they progress or if they don't tolerate the therapy. And I think that because having that conversation with patients is hard to get their mindset from cure to survival with, sometimes people change treatment too quickly. So, and it ends up being the same thing. Patients go through too many different regimens very quickly, and then they're left with no options, which to me is a harder pill to swallow.
You mentioned pegylated liposomal doxorubicin. What do you think about its value in ovarian cancer, and are you able to access it?
Well, it was for a long time one of those really valuable drugs that we had that was pretty well tolerated in recurrent ovarian cancer and had activity and had different toxicities than most of the other agents, and so was a really nice option for a lot of women. I have been able to get some of it for a few limited patients over the last few months, but for a year that sort of option went away, which is a shame because there were a lot of clinical trials that were either ongoing or in development that were using that as one of the agents in the arms for recurrent ovarian cancer. So I think, you know, long term, how easy is it going to be for us to get and how available is it? I don't know. I hope that it becomes easier and easier again because I do think it's a very good tool. And because it doesn't cause neuropathy and it doesn't cause a lot of nausea and vomiting, and somebody who's been on a taxane or something else that causes a lot of neuropathy, it's a nice option for women. Also, because it doesn't cause alopecia, it's a nice option for women with recurrent ovarian cancer who've just regrown their hair and, you know they're not going to be cured, but they kind of don't want to lose their hair again. And so I hope that it becomes more and more available. And I think that it's sort of put a little bit of a squash on some of the recurrent trials that we've had in the last year or so because they were designed around it. And you can't go back and substitute drug from a different source to continue a trial. And we don't have enough data from the new source of the drug. For sure, I think for most people to be comfortable putting it into trial. So hopefully time will tell and it will come back to be a good option for women with recurrence.